Mr. Tudor, I wonder if you could first tell some of our listeners, as well as the gentleman sitting around the table here, if you could tell us what NICAP is.
NICAP is a non-profit private organization which is designed to collect and evaluate and make public all authentic information on unidentified flying objects or flying saucers. It has membership in 27 states, 14 foreign countries, and on its board includes such distinguished citizens as Vice Admiral R.A. Schoenfelder, who used to be Director of CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, Rear Admiral Lowell, Colonel R.B. Ellison, Army retired, Major Foreman, who used to be the number one investigator on UFOs for the Air Force in the Pentagon, and a number of others, scientists, educators, religious men. We have a panel of experts in various fields who have to evaluate sightings and other developments, and then we try to cover these publicly in magazines and bulletins. And our aim is to try to get the subject out in the open and to get Congress to have open hearings for the finalists to prevent secrecy.
You say, Major General, that you want the subject to be brought in the open. What do you think should be brought out there? Is there something that we don't know as citizens of this country?
There's a very great deal. In the first place, pilots in the armed forces, and that's all members of the armed forces, are liable to a great degree in regard to sightings reports. And of course, constantly denies this, but I have in front of me here constitutes the official orders, Janet 146, Joint Chiefs of Staff document, and AFR 200, that's an Air Force order, which says that no one will discuss any unexplained sightings. And what we listen to the press,
of course. What is your opinion about this, Major Keogh? What is the reason that they're trying to silence these people?
Well, for a long time, the policy has been to explain away these sightings while behind the scenes they're very seriously investigating and trying to get all the answers. They're also trying to find the secret of propulsion so that we can duplicate it. I agree in the last phase that they're right in keeping everything they learn technically to themselves. I think it's a great mistake to deceive the public, treat the American people like children. The way it was there for a long time about the H-bomb. I mean, everybody was told that, yes, it was something that was based on an A-bomb. And we didn't let us know that we could be blown out off the map. And for a long time, missiles and submarines were in the same category. Now, right now, 40 or 60% of the country could be wiped out by missiles and subs. Now, that was hushed up for a long time.
Do you think that this country is in danger from the possibility of an attack by people who may live on other planets?
I never thought so because the modern series goes back 10 years in the World War II, and they've had plenty of time if they wanted to attack us. Unless it's a very, very long range preparation. Of course, there have been a few accidents, and some people view those as evidence of hostility. But I think we're merely under observation. And it's taken a long time because we are probably having difficulty in understanding it and deciding what to do. We not only have to communicate.
Pardon me. What planet do you think that these UFOs are coming from? What do you like to call them, sir? How do you like
to call them? I like to call them UFOs because even though you'll find the word point source in the title of every book I've written, that's because a lot of people don't know what UFOs are. They're glad we're coming around to it, but it helps to make the subject a little more serious. It's a very silly word, a term, flying saucers. It's an unfortunate thing. If we call them discs, it would have helped. Unidentified objects. But a lot of people hate to admit they believe in flying saucers just because of that name. I like to call them UFOs.
Well, first let's take care of a little business. Possibly, Clark, you'd like to get in at about this time. I know that you've known us for a long while to have the opportunity of talking with Major Keogh. Is that a call we have no idea?
So I'd be very glad to be
able to see you for a moment. Go right ahead. I understand that there's a call that came in for Major Keogh, and we hope that it may be something that will be of interest to our listeners, because if we have something that we think that we may have, I think it will be of extreme interest to all concerned. Major Keogh, just as we were going to talk to you again, there was a call for you, a long-distance call. I was just wondering, is that a personal call, or was it something that may be of interest to our listeners?
Well, I think it would interest almost anyone who
is interested in flying first the subject. This came from Captain Joe Hall of Capital Airlines. Captain Hall is a veteran. He's been flying 18 years, 16,000 hours, most of them at the controls and airliner. Now, this is not a personal sighting of his, but it's one from a lieutenant in the United States Navy, and we checked on it and backed it 100%. It's a battery. Captain Hall himself had a sighting which was reported from Mexico, a very strange one, as he was flying from New York to New York. On this flight, he was also flying from New York to New York, and this naval pilot, and we can't give his name, although I have it in front of me, because you have to do a custom permission before you can move him on the air like that. He reported this sighting on December 11th, 1955. He and another Navy pilot were flying from Jacksonville Naval Air Station, Jacksonville, Florida, were flying two guard jets on a practice mission. It was a clear night, and they hadn't seen anything in the sky. Suddenly they received an urgent message from the tower to go to fly directly out over the ocean, and they were vectored, that is, guided, on a certain course. They flew several miles on this course, and they suddenly discovered in front of them an object with an orange-red glare to it, which as soon as they started to close in, began to maneuver at very high speed. Now, each one of these Cougar jets was equipped with radar, and they picked up this strange UFO, a flying saucer, but they couldn't get a lock on. That is, the radar would not lock on, then guide the planes automatically, because each time they tried to close in, this strange object would either accelerate to tremendous speed, or else it would climb up to a very high altitude. In fact, the altitude during the chase varied from 6,000 to 30,000 feet. And the speed varied from about a slow cruising speed, as they could make with a jet, up to near sonic, which is roughly over 700 miles an hour in sea weather. So during this chase, they were constantly receiving reports from the tower, but by that time the tower was filled with high-altitude officers in Jacksonville Naval Air Station, and that they were being tracked by radar at Jacksonville, which showed the blips of the two jets and the UFO without maneuvering them. They were also getting reports, telephone calls, from people all over the area, so they had this direct, authentic reports from more than 100 ground witnesses. Now, this particular report was checked by Hall. He found out the name of the other pilot involved. He said there was no doubt in his mind that this was an authentic sighting, and with the pilot told him that they felt absolutely ridiculous, because there they were in high-speed jets, and this thing was just making monkeys out of him. This may not sound as dramatic as some of the sightings that have been published, but if you stop and think, the men involved who trained Navy pilots, and when I'm investigating it, a veteran airline captain, I think it should make an impression. It's just really a very interesting case.
Major Hewitt, I will have so many questions to ask you, and I know that I have dozens of them, but I think in all fairness, Charles, we'll give you a little chance for a couple of minutes anyway.
One question which has interested me, Major, is I believe you mentioned several times that there is, to your mind, or at least to the mind of NICAP, a good possibility that the saucers are using perhaps Mars as a base of operations for observing Earth.
What's that question?
And I think you said that one of the things which led you to believe this was that the incidence of sightings had increased every time Mars was nearby over the past 10 years.
That's right.
Well, the thing which makes me curious about this is if indeed these objects are interplanetary, perhaps inter-system ships, which they must be capable of pretty fantastic range and speed and so forth, why would they even bother with a little thing like the extra distance across the solar system?
Well, that's a very good question. Of course, we don't know the maximum speed or the propulsion method. It's really speculation based on sort of an educated guess. The first time that this increase was noted, they were just considered a coincidence. That was in 48. It was another very beginning in 50, very good in 52. And after the Canadian government project decided at that time that they would make it official. It had been an unofficial deal until then. But
far as the people are concerned, it may be that there are large units which do take advantage of the closeness of Mars to discharge smaller ones which they leave in our area operating as a weak celestial wind operation in the moon. I don't know, there are serious no speculations, I say, but it is our record, however, there has been an increase which precedes the opposition of Mars and lasts anywhere from 2 to 3 months afterwards.
Major Sierra, do you think that the officials of the Air Force actually believe that there are UFOs arriving here on this planet, at least hovering over this planet, that are coming here from other planets, from Mars at least?
You didn't say how many. If you knew the entire Air Force,
I would say there is
a sizable group in the Air Force, and I know that the time when I was working with it, which was back in 52 and 53, there was a very good percentage that believed it, not only believed it, but that the public should know about it.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been documents drawn up by it, which tells us also. Stating their belief in that. And of course, the most important one was the 1948 top secret estimate, which the Air Force, for the first time tonight, came out and denied. They denied because they were on the spot with that talk.
Was that on the microwave?
That's right.
That was where the denial was made.
That's where the denial was made. It was given to Mike Wallace. What happened was that I had tried to say, if the Air Force had these documents, I tried to say that on the Armstrong program, January 22nd, meeting. The Air Force representative, according to Mr. Ernst Toomey, the writer for Armstrong, who told him that that was actually the case that I, the Air Force, would immediately deny it, and even if it meant denouncing the source. The source, not me, but Captain Edward Rupert, who is former chief of Project Rupert. Now, Rupert has stated the existence of those documents in his book, which was cleared by Security Review of the Air Force. I checked on that. It was cleared December 1st, 1955. They did not want that statement made.
Who didn't want the statement made?
The Air Force did not want it made.
They
didn't get it to us. They're going to put it down. They're going to publish it anyway. So they got it. But Spanish, they had refused to answer questions about that for a long time. I had my friend there asking specifically about it. And one of 11 questions, Mrs. General Bill Kelly, who was a legislative liaison, who voted all the questions, including that one. Nobody had ever seen the Air Force down until tonight. I had told Wallace that I had this as proof of it. And Mrs. General was actually on two. I showed a portion of the script in which this was marked right out. And anybody can identify that as part of the Armstrong script because it's in the same type that you can see. I've got all those scripts.
Can you read that part of the script to it tonight?
Yes.
I'd like to hear that. While you're getting that ready, sir, let me take a moment to talk about one of our sponsors, and then we'll be back with Major Seahawk. I would like to have you give me your opinion, if you will, please, on two questions. Number one, why didn't Lou Pelt appear on that program? According to TV Guide, he was listed.
Well, that's right. He at first accepted the invitation. According to Mr. Toomey, the Armstrong writer, he was quite enthusiastic about it. And later he said he didn't realize he'd have to be there for rehearsal for 2 or 3 days, and that he just couldn't spare the time. That may be the exact answer. It's also possible that since he was an aircraft company, that they decided maybe it was just as well not. But they did agree that I was on I got a ticket program sometime before, so I feel that is a quick answer.
Now the next question says, Kenneth Arnold was in town. He was at rehearsals, I think, for 2 days, and he refused to appear on the program, and it was his opinion. And I have the telegram in front of me, a copy of it. He says in this telegram, I will not be a participant on any program that obviously misrepresents and distorts the facts available on any subject broadcast for the public interest.
Nor would I allow any photographs or material properly copyrighted to be used on any program without written permission of the owner.
You hear Mr. Arnold was correct in that statement?
Well, of course, quite a bit. I could tell at the end of the first day that he wasn't happy about it, and the second day that he was thinking of pulling out. And I hadn't seen them first, and he was checking out a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him I thought it'd be better if he'd stay on because it would look bad, you know, that he didn't even be up for it. And he said that he thought that it was a rigged program, or that may not be a rebellion, as much as I expect. And he had wanted to face certain things, and they said there was not enough time for it. I didn't overhear his discussion with the writers and producers, but I knew that he was defensively getting unhappy about it. And he said to myself, and they got it about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and of course somebody else had to read this section.
And now before you read this statement, sir, I wonder if you can give me your opinion for the reason. Why did they even produce or even think of this particular show if they were going to run into so many problems? And certainly the Air Force must have informed Robert Costello and Herb Tunick that they were not going to agree with you, and they were not going to let you just make any statement that you felt would be right to do.
Well, I can give you two or three angles on that. I don't know whether you may have seen these letters. I'll go back to the first. They told me that I was the first one that they approached.
And I really think
Mr. Tunick called me and asked whether NICAP would cooperate putting on a program on UFOs. I said, yes, we'd be glad to, as long as we were given a fair representation. He said, well, we'd be glad to do that, and that's advice. I gave him some ideas, and I was thinking at the time that it was going to be a panel discussion, I said, be sure to get the Air Force in there. He said, well, you'll be having a little trouble with the Air Force. I said, well, tell them that if they don't put somebody on, this can be announced on the air that the Air Force is given full chance to on this side and I refuse to let anyone off. Whether or not that's good, I don't know. But anyway, we call back to the Air Force is now the list of self-loading staff. We're giving this full cooperation. So the first thing I knew, a script came down showing the Air Force had all of part two, and I had 5 minutes of part two, we had 3 minutes, and that's where the Air Force had the rest of it, which made a balance of over. Looking through the war in time. I talked about it, and I said, well, you should have asked for equal time at the start, which was true, but I had thought it was a discussion show.
Did they give you any reason?
They said that
would be entitled to equal time?
They said they thought that Douglas Edwards' presentation was more from NICAP's viewpoint than the Air Force, that it was really on our side and it helped balance it. I do say that he did get a very fair picture of it, but it was not NICAP's story. And they said, well, we'll squeeze in a few more minutes if we can. And we felt backed out, and I got his time, and they squeezed in another minute or two. I think they were going to get to about 10 or 11.
Is this including the time that you were talking, that the cops were called?
I don't know. It wasn't time exactly. It was something like that. So then, on Sunday before the show, I was talking to some of our voting governors, and they said, you don't like that script. It's all the TV. And I agreed. They said, well, we have these points. I'm going to look at these four documents that I'm going to tell you about, which should be mentioned, and other things. And meanwhile, I had been told that the Air Force would not go on the show if there was going to be any personalities. And also, I was told that I could not mention the orders with Michael Pilot.
Now, that you did mention on this
side. I didn't mention. I mentioned just now.
Mm-hmm.
But I was told I couldn't mention one on my program.
Otherwise, I'm pretty stupid.
Well, you're open minded. Well, we were in a spot. Anyway, he said, we'll do the best we can. But then I insisted on the change, so I completely rewrote the script that night. And the minute I got up there, it was a typewriter. I wrote it off at the University of Belgrade. And it wasn't until either late that afternoon or the next day that the Air Force man discovered this to me. About these third estimates. At that time, those two came over and said that they weren't allowed to go on as is without paper. And they will immediately deny it and deny the source. Now,
If you want me to, I'll read the statement back.
I don't know who I want to make it, yes.
Well, here is the statement which Christ asked. I'm going to read the opening part of that statement that we did hear.
Yeah,
those people don't know who saw the telecast, there may be some who missed it.
And
tell us when you're reading the part that they would not
commit to the
divine. I don't have the preceding page, but I can remember.
Well,
Edwards asked me what was the reason for the wide difference of statements between Lancaster, myself, and the Air Force. And then the Air Force says they don't exist, we say they do exist. And I said there should be two reasons. One of them was an honest difference of opinion among analysts. Second, there was an official policy believed in the best interest of the people, not to confirm the existence of UFOs until all answers are known. And then this was supposed to follow. Captain Edward J. Rupert, former chief of Project Blue Book, has confirmed the existence of four important Air Force documents that should be noted. In 1948, in a top secret estimate, ACIC, of the Aerospace Intelligence Center, concluded the UFOs were interplanetary spaceships. In 1952, an Air Force intelligence analysis of UFO maneuvers brought the same conclusion in the planetary. In 1953, a report by a panel of top scientists at the Pentagon reached this conclusion. There is strong circumstantial evidence, but no concrete proof that the UFOs are spaceships. They recommended we simplifying the investigation and drawing the United States for all effects. Now that is the part that was cut out. You'll notice there are only three documents mentioned. Just before that, apparently the state space, Tunis or someone had cut out the 1947 document that said that these things were real, whatever they were.
Now, wasn't this on the teleconference?
No, it was not on the teleconference because for 2 days we were hit with six. I think at the end of the second day we were with the teleconference. Yes, the proof never was put on the teleconference. And at that time, I was grateful to the assembly that we were allowing it to be cut out or else not going on the air. It wasn't stated that way. It never said that the Armstrong people couldn't have any fight at that time. I mean, I would make a statement. The Air Force would deny it and end up showing Captain Newfound a liar. If they had done that, I would have said to produce some other evidence that I had. But to avoid it, I was afraid that I'd be out of it completely, and Air Force would simply have it concerned. It was just a very real thing to talk back to the Air Force.
One point, Major Keyhart. I saw that telecast, and I imagine that you were allotted about 5 minutes after the Air Force representative. According to my opinion, it was about 5 minutes that you talked. Now, I was under the impression that you were reading from a teleprompter, several of the statements that you made that would possibly confirm the existence of the UFO.
I did, that's right.
That, in other words, that
was
a
teleprompter. Yeah,
yes. Yeah. Now, what happened when you came to that final 20 seconds? Was the teleprompter blank?
No. What had happened was this. I was given more bound up to use the colloquialism at the fact that the UFO had too much time. And the proof had been cut out of the script, and as they were yet, the public was getting an unfair picture. So I mentioned to one of the Armstrong representatives that we had been working with the Senate subcommittee on UFO secrecy for about 6 months. And they had a lot of evidence, and that they were considering possibility of public hearing. And I said, if I put that in there, how would that be? And he said, you thought it would be terrific. But I understood later that he had no authority to open such a thing. And what I should have done is go to Bob Costello, the producer. Until I made up my mind, we were in the air, we got to a certain point, and I just tried to stick in a line ad-libbing with about the Senate Committee.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I got to the word Senate Committee, they cut off the audio on my mic. It came over Doug Edwards, something to good here, something.
Yeah, I have it on tape.
Yes. But that was what I was trying to say. I was not going to mention this other stuff that was deleted because I promised not to.
But I hope that you'll tell us something about the things that were deleted on the discussion that we had this morning. Mr. Seahoe, I think you mentioned on that telecast, and of course we'd like to have the other information that you were not permitted to read or mention over the Armstrong Circle Theater that particular evening. But I think you mentioned something about a Senate committee.
Yes.
Were you referring to the McClellan Committee, sir?
The McClellan Subcommittee, which is the permanent subcommittee on government operations, yes. That's the committee.
That's the committee, yes. I had not given that name out before because at one time they said, don't reveal on the responsible mayor. But after the Amstrad program, somebody guessed it, and Paul Parker answered about it, called him, got permission to name it for him. He put it on the air.
Who did he get permission from?
If you want to go around to it later, I'll ask some other items that were
in the original manuscript set up for us.
Well, no, I would appreciate it very much if you'd like to comment on them right now, sir.
Oh, I see.
The listeners will naturally be very interested.
I don't say that this was censorship, because I couldn't ask for it. Unless they'd given me even time, they couldn't have covered all this. I was hoping that they would actually be forced into giving me the time of the interest to come in. Well, then I went to sit with the Prince of Indianapolis for practically half a city saw an object in 1952 and statement by a definition priest who saw that a regular old camera. He said that this was a controlled class of some sort, and he was perfectly convinced. Then I had a military priest by military captain Don Holland, and the fact that his father was controlled by Major General William G. Manley, USMC, who said he did start it, and that it was an authentic study. Then I mentioned the fact that the main interest pilots were made in the train in Air Force Reels. And I had in the Far East Air Force report of an encounter in December 1956. And this is remember that was described in our memory.
In spite of that, the Air Force came out and released a public statement that this man had been drug fighting with a balloon. Now that's another thing that was not on the air. Most of the other has to do with sightings. Oh, there was one other thing, Special Report 14. That's the Air Force Blue Book report, in which they say that they analyzed 3,201 cases, and they had, in the back of this, they showed the table, that 19.5% were unexplained. In other words, to add on the rest that they hadn't explained on up to date, it makes a total of more than 700. They admit 5,700, so 700 out of 5,700, or more than 12%, are unexplained. And the Air Force admits that, but they come out and say, we are currently explaining 1.9%. And the word currently gets dropped out, and everybody thinks the Air Force has explained that all but 2% of the sightings. I had that in there, and part of it was left in. The one other thing that I wanted to mention was the fact that the Air Force said that they could not build a working model of a flying saucer because they had 12 cases out of all these that they called the cream of the crop, and that all of them were describing different objects. And this is by the fact that in 1949, Project Grudge report was released temporarily and later was classified. And it said that there were several groups. Group 1, the most numerous, described a disc-shaped object, apparently metallic, which had a diameter 10 times the thickness of the object. These things were capable of swift accelerations and high-speed turns. The second group was luminous objects seen at night, and the third group was cigar-shaped objects. Now, you certainly can make working models out of a disc or a cigar-shaped object. So here's Special Report 14, was apparently let out to deceive the American people. And this was denounced shortly afterwards by Captain Luthor, the former head of the project, who said that he was responsible for having this thing drawn up, and when it came in, everybody agreed it was practically working. And it's still being put over as the official document of the Air Force.
Major, there's a question on these documents. And to my understanding, you knew the contents of these documents through Captain Luthor. Is that correct?
And others.
Now, earlier this evening, the Air Force, through Mr. Wallace, denied that three of these things ever existed and stated that the fourth document did exist, but that its contents were pretty diametrically opposite to what you claimed. In fact, they claimed, I think it was a statement of Secretary Horner, that in fact the contents of this document were that the public should be widely informed, true, but they should be widely informed that there was no evidence to support the hypothesis that there were flying saucers or spaceships or what have you. Now, earlier you said that on the Armstrong Federal Theater they did not want to get into this because the Air Force would deny the existence of them and would in fact be calling Captain Rupert a liar. Now, can I assume that the Air Force has now called Captain Rupert a liar through its statement of earlier this evening?
It would appear to me that they had, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that raises quite a number of points because
yes.
He's not the only one who confirmed the existence of these documents.
Mm-hmm.
I learned of the existence of two of them a long time before when his book came out. Now, there's a very funny thing about the one they do admit. This was not an Air Force document solely. It was originally an investigation, or rather, an examination of evidence by scientists called together by the Central Intelligence Agency. They ran the show with the Air Force producing the evidence they had. And these scientists, top global scientists, aviation linguists, astronomers, and so on, were called in to advise the Air Force what to do. Now, the one recommendation in there, which is very important, is that they said you should quadruple the size of the project and set up special observation posts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's one thing that people in the project have been fighting for. Rupo mentions in there that Major General William Garland, who was a graduate of ATIC, came to the Pentagon and fought for this and was finally turned down. He wanted it carried through, the thing quadrupled in their observation posts and so forth. It'd be very easy to call Garland and Colonel Gunn, Frank Gunn, and others, Rupo mentions in there, and it's interesting to note that nobody mentioned by Rupo in that book has ever come out and said, that's a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And copies of that book went to every officer in there who's mentioned in it. There is no question that those things exist, but the minute the Air Force admits it, then they are on the spot.
Well, with it then finally having denied it, seems that it is no longer a case of perhaps concealing things from the public, but it is now pretty much a flat case of somebody, either Captain Ruppelt and the other gentlemen, or the official representatives of the Air Force are just plain lying.
Well, I don't like to use the word lying. Here's what I would like to say, that there are people who think that it is wiser not to let the American people know any bad news.
Mm-hmm.
That's been prevalent, and it's more and more prevalent in Washington today. Big Brother will decide what is best for the American people, and I think it's wrong. Now, when I say I'm speaking for most of the people on our board of governors, and you could say, as well, I started out saying, well, everybody's connected with it seems to be a crackpot or something else. Now, we have Vice Admiral R.A. Chillingcutter, as I mentioned. He was formerly head of the CIA. He had a wonderful war record. Rear Admiral Herbert Mills was also a fine war record. Colonel Robert Emerson, USAR, who occasionally goes on active duty for the Army today, investigated this for years. J.B. Hartranft, who's president of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, the largest organization in the world of pilot pilots. Major Fournay, who was on the project, and the number one man in Washington, number one investigator. Quite a number of people. Well, Frank Edwards, you just mentioned him, I identified him a while ago, and some religious leaders, the Professor Mayne of Defiance University. And we have a number of other people who will not let their names be used, but who are special advisors in various fields, among top rocket and missile men. These people, most of them, will agree that the Air Force is keeping facts from the public.
May I ask you this, Major Keogh? You've given us a list of names here. Would you go on record here this morning and make the statement that all of these people whose names you have just listed to us, would you say that they all believe that these UFOs are interplanetary?
No, I won't say that because there's a variation in there, and I do hope to have a statement on that out within the next week or two. At least there will be a statement by a majority of the board on this question of censorship. Some of the board members, and I think it goes up to more than 50%, believe that these things are interplanetary. I'm not going to identify them until each one has given me permission. Some of them are absolutely convinced of it. Some of them say it looks like it. They're almost convinced. And others say, I'd still like to see some more evidence.
One quick question, and then I'll have to take care of the business majors. Are you representing NICAP this morning, or are you talking as Major Donald E. Kehoe?
I'm representing NICAP, and anytime you want my personal views or side, it's a little hard to split myself apart. But what I have said up to now is as a director of NICAP.
I have one brief question to ask you, sir, and then there's no doubt my other panel members around here have a number of questions, too. I heard the interview, I saw and heard the interview with Mike Wallace last night, and I noticed when the name Menger and Adamski was brought up, you gave a very, very quick answer. You were not interested. I think that was your answer.
Well, I'd like to qualify that for this reason. Now, I had an answer ready for that particular question.
Mm-hmm.
But I have been under the impression that the commercial break was in the middle of that show, and that I still would have after that, 10 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
So when the commercial break came up, and one of the program officials came over and said, "You've got 3 minutes after this time," and he'd already had the question on the line there.
Yes.
And I thought, good heavens, I was getting ready to lay some hot stuff out and put in some documents and letters I was going to read. And so, I know I'm going to dispose of that as quickly as possible. It was not with the intention of sounding hard-boiled, because I immediately tried to add that our policy has been one to examine all the evidence, and we have written all of the chief contactees and asked them if they would send in the evidence, and if they would attend public hearings, take lie detector tests, and so on. Now, that answer should have been, no, I don't accept it, the board doesn't accept anything, because we don't think anyone has presented verified evidence. But I was rushing through trying to get to my main points before Mike Walsh can cut me off, and that's why it sounded very explosive. It was not meant as an insult type of answer, but it was meant as an emphatic, quick answer to get on to before my few minutes were gone.
Well, I hope you realize that you have plenty of time to give us some of that information.
Charles, there was a question that was suggested as one of the eight. In fact, we had originally about 20, and it just got to be too long, and cut it down. Now, I don't know how I would react if I'd had a contact. And somebody said to me about lie detector tests, I would check very carefully into who was making the test,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps to see there were two or three people there, and that they were in no way connected with the military, and I would insist that one of them not be connected with NICAP. I never want to get the reaction of these people to see whether, under certain conditions, they would accept it, or whether, and also whether they'd come for public hearing.
Had anybody accepted the test?
If I remember correctly, two people did. One of them was Angelucci. Van Tassel.
Van Tassel agreed to submit to a live
account. I will have to check, but my memory is to that effect. I think we have it in the magazine here. We printed the replies that we've got.
So what happened?
Well, the point is this, we have stated that if whenever NICAP was able to have these hearings, it's going to be an expensive proposition to transport somebody from the West Coast and to put him up there for whatever time it takes for these hearings. And I also have always said that I felt the investigation of factual sightings should come first.
Major Kehoe, don't you think, though, that that's a rather unfortunate situation? In other words, let us say as an example that I one night come in front of this microphone and I say that I was driving down the Jersey Turnpike and I saw a light in the sky and something landed near the side of the highway and it was a Venusian spaceship and I took a ride in it. Of course, I do this show and there'd be some people would believe me and many people wouldn't believe me, the same as any of the others. So immediately you hear about it and you send me one of these forms to fill out. And I fill it out, and I agree. Yes, by all means, Major Kehoe, bring the lie detector test up.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you possibly sent this form maybe to 40 or 50 people, and I am one of three people who've agreed to submit to the lie detector.
Mm-hmm.
The outcome of it is you don't have this available at the present time. Wouldn't you say that this would sort of imply that I am honest and that I'm telling a legitimate story because I'm willing to submit to it?
I wouldn't say that implies that 100%.
No, not a
lot of people that will agree to anything because they are convinced of what they're saying. You know that sometimes a man can be so convinced of the truth after he said it enough times that he might even be able to pass the lie detector test. I've been told
of that too. Yes.
I think that's possible. The whole thing was unfortunate. I did not want to cook the roll into this contact business too soon because I felt that your first job is to convince the American people and the press these things are real. After that, the other thing can move right order.
Don't you think that's the easiest way? And believe me, I'm not being critical of you, sir, in NICAP. I'm not in the position to be, and I don't think it's my right to be. But you sit here, Major Kehoe, and you tell us about these sightings, and they're extremely interesting.
And, of course, you have no tangible proof to afford us this morning, except the fact that this pilot and that pilot and this Air Force general has made the statement. These are fine and dandy. But don't you think it would prove more to the American public that there is something to this story? It could be proven that these fellows who claim that they've been talking to Venusians and Martians, that it could be proven that they're telling the truth. I don't buy it myself, frankly, Major.
It
would be easier to sell me the idea that this is something that...
I've got to answer that. Before I do, I want to make one little correction there about not having anything tangible. There are photographs, and there are photographs of radar scopes showing triangulation of objects, and there are pieces of metal which have fallen from objects which have disintegrated and which we reported as UFOs just before we did. So I would say there is some tangible evidence. Now, to go into this evidence, I know quite a number of better newspaper men and a number of newscasters in Washington. I said, what is your opinion? What's the best policy for NICAP? That's why I was put in there and inherited, and sometimes wish I'd never been born. But anyway, I said, no matter what you personally believe, it is smarter to concentrate on your factual studies, because the minute you start in on any other angle, you're going to lose the press. Then you will start being ridiculed as having accepted contact stories. Whether you accept them or not, the minute you start sounding as though you do. Because the best advice we can give you is not even to mention them. Don't say yes or no, just keep still. So I tried that at first. It didn't work. The pressure's built up because there are many people who are sincerely convinced that these things are true. And some people who accept all of them. And some people who accept a few. The pressure got so great that I was accused of clamping a lid. See, I only got trying to expose censorship, and I'm clamping a lid on the contact story. So I said, all right. So I got advice from a lot of people about a policy. And we set out these questions, and we did not send them to a lot of people because we selected the best known ones. Mm-hmm. So by now, I think hundreds who claim contact or communication here and abroad. So it didn't satisfy anybody. The people that don't believe in, they wrote in and said, what are you bothering with us for? What's the idea? Now, we thought NICAP was a factual organization. The people who believe in the contacts wrote in and said, here you are trying to force people to take larger tests. The result is it's no better than it was. I will say this. I have tried very hard, and tonight's class is the first time that I have said anything that sounded a little hard-boiled. I tried very hard to say we are going to be impartial. If anybody can bring in absolute proof that will convince not me, but the advisors and the board, that will be right out in writing with a NICAP sign on it. Chuck?
Now, which leads up to the question is, I wonder if perhaps you as the director of NICAP, or perhaps such as Donald Kehoe, private citizen, feel that the contact stories are damaging your case.
I think they are delaying acceptance of UFO reality by most people in the United States. And I said that in a statement of policy in, I think, our second issue. I said, no matter what you believe, why don't you take it easy and let's prove that these sightings are correct. Take the most factual ones you can get, and once the newspapers buy it, and the networks buy it, the individual broadcasters, nothing can stop investigation of every phase, everything, the communication claims, the contact claims, every angle of it will immediately be explored, because then it will be the biggest story they've got. And they'll jump on it, you'll have thousands of people writing and talking about it from then on. So let's get the facts in there. And that's the one thing the Air Force is worried about. They love the contact stories, because it helps them to laugh it off. Now, there may be somewhere or other, there may be a guy with a contact story that is absolutely 100% true, and he's being crucified. I will admit that in my book, particularly the second one, I took some crack. I treated the subject very lightly, and if I were to write another one now, I don't know what I would do. I probably would state the NICAP policy and keep my own opinion out of it.
One brief question, Major Kehoe. You have made the statement a couple of times this morning that you feel that the government is acting as sort of a big brother. They're going to tell us the things that they think that we can stand to hear, and the things that we shouldn't hear, they're not going to tell us about. Now, in other words, what you've implied is that they possibly know as much as you do, maybe even a little bit more about these things that are flying around, and possibly they know that they're coming from other planets. You sort of implied it. Anyway, now, my question is just this. Is it possible, sir, that maybe some foreign government, I'm talking about a government on this planet, that maybe they've developed something that acts like UFOs, and maybe our government is familiar with the fact that it's maybe something that was built by Russia, and that they don't want to tell us that because they're afraid that it may cause too much concern?
Well, that, of course, was the first answer that the Air Force and the Navy and the Army considered back in 47 when they had the mass sightings.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of scared people running around the Pentagon when these things finally seemed to be real. And then they began to take some stock and said, well, either the Soviets have had a terrific leap here, and less than 10 years since the end of World War II, and they devastated factories, and in fact, it's been nothing, and all of a sudden they've got a perfect global weapon, or else these are coming from somewhere else. So they did a hasty intelligence job. The end of 6 months, with the help of the British, they had ruled out any possibility this could be Russian. And now, just to say for a minute that they were Russian, it would mean that since 1940, actually, since the middle of World War II, the Russians had something in operation, or maybe it was the Germans, and Russia took it over. And then they perfected it by 47. For 11 years, they've been building ordinary jets and working like mad to build missiles and get weapons in the air, where they already had the ultimate perfect device and weapon. They were letting us fight them, when all I had to do was take one of these things and say, we are going to have it over the center of Wichita, Kansas tomorrow, and everybody better get out of there, because when we have it over there, we're going to drop something, and they could prove it without any doubt, and they would have owned the world by now. I don't think there's any possibility of a Soviet answer, and the U.S. secret weapon answer rules out the same way, because we wouldn't be so afraid, and we would certainly not have failed to put Sputniks in the air. And we would not be building ordinary jets and missiles.
Some time ago, Major, I had some correspondence with Mr. Reinhold Schmidt in Kearney, Nebraska, and I received a 6-page letter in answer to a letter I had sent him. And I do have the impression, though I may be entirely wrong, that NICAP had sent him a letter or a questionnaire, had contacted him. Do you have any recollection of it?
No, we do not.
You did not?
No. In fact, I think there was some confusion there between the man in Washington named Wayne Aho, because I received a call from a radio station or a newspaper out there wanting to know what we had asked Mr. Smith, and I said, we hadn't asked him anything. And I said, well, he said that the head of this Washington Crawford group had asked him. I said, well, chances are it's Aho. Sometimes the names are confused.
I assume there's no relationship between Mr. Aho and yourself.
No, he spelled his name A-H-O.
There's two Ahos. There's Major Wayne Aho and there's Arthur Aho.
Oh,
that's a brother who's associated with George Van Tassel, Arthur Aho.
That's right, I know the rest one.
But I was interested primarily in the claim of mistreatment, so to speak, of Schmidt. I don't have the letter with me, but the idea basically, as he expressed it, was to save Schmidt from himself. He thought he might have suicidal tendencies. So he was put away by a psychiatric ward, which frankly didn't make much sense to me.
I think that's entirely false, George, but John wants the mic.
I'll have to take it for a moment anyway, gentlemen.
But in connection with the Air Force, I'd like to ask the Major if he has any idea why there apparently has been a change in policy. I assume there has been a change from the early 50s to the present time. Would that be due to personnel entirely?
No, it was due to the fact that at one time one group was a little more powerful, and then somebody would be transferred, and then another top-level officer would come in and throw his weight. The policy, the first, 1947, was one of bafflement and let's see what's going on, and then they began to suspect what it was and put it under wraps, and then right upon the 48, there was some talk about putting it out, and that got knocked down, and then it was completely
under wraps for a couple of years, and they began to get open again. Let's get serious about it. In 52, they finally decided, let's get it out and tell the people, even though we don't have proof and full answers. And in 53, they almost got away with it, and then it was knocked down, but hard, and from then on, the censorship was getting tighter and tighter, to the point where they will even contradict things that they have put in writing before, and you put them side by side, it's obvious. One of them can't be true. In fact, that's shown up here, the very time of the Armstrong, a theater deal. Here you had an Armstrong theater, you had the Assistant Secretary Horner say, it was a mistake to believe that the Air Force was withholding anything, and I do not qualify this in any way. Now, that was the 22nd. On the 23rd of January, Captain Gregory H. Oldenburg, Langley Air Force Base, Virginia, wrote a letter to one of the NICAP members who had asked if he could submit an advertisement to run in the Langley Flyer. That's the base newspaper. And all it was say, we'd like to hear from those interested in forming a local affiliate of a national investigation network on the origin of flying saucers and UFOs, with the public dissemination of the data so obtained. And this captain says, and this is on Air Force Stationery, I objected to the running of this ad because I felt that it would encourage Air Force personnel to violate present Air Force policy and specifically Air Force Regulation 200-2. Within 24 hours after the Air Force Secretary says, nobody's hiding anything, here's a man comes out right to it. Not only that, at the bottom of this, after turning down a much weaker advertisement, he says, although the wording of these two ads has been changed, it is my belief that one of the objectives of your organization is the public dissemination of data on unidentified flying objects. As I pointed out to you on the 20th of January, this is contrary to Air Force policy and regulation. Now, that's on record. Now, here's a man who says if he gets the policy and regulations to disseminate any data, the Assistant Secretary of the Air gets on and says we're not hiding the thing. On top of that, Major General Kelly writes a letter to NICAP in which he says, you will note that this release reaffirms the United States Air Force position as to the non-existence of flying saucers. Shortly after that, he wrote a letter to, well, it was quite a little after that, to Senator Goldwater, asking about my being knocked off the air, and that was answered by Horner himself, in which he says, the allegations that the Air Force has withheld information on UFOs are entirely in error. Who are you going to believe, and why?
I'd like to ask you one question, Major Kehoe. You mentioned earlier this morning that you felt that possibly the Air Force told the producer and the writer of the Armstrong Circle Theater that certain material should be deleted from that telecast. This was your impression. Am I right, sir?
Yes.
Am I misquoting you?
That's what I was told.
Yes, sir. If this is true, and I have no reason to believe otherwise, why is it that I can sit up here 7 nights a week, and I certainly don't want to appear to be an egotist, that this is a great, important show for the nation, but nevertheless, it is available to a lot of people. A lot of people can listen to it because we cover 27 states.
Mm-hmm.
And how is it that no one came over to me and said, or sent me a wire or a letter and said, John, when you have this fella Kehoe on tonight, don't let him say anything about the Air Force. Don't let him say this, that, and the other thing.
There's a very good reason. You don't have an Air Force representative here. The minute you get an Air Force representative in this room, I am censored. You're not going to be able to let me speak freely.
I wonder if Charles is going to put something.
Maybe.
Semi-official, and they didn't deal with anybody.
I'm glad you clarify that.
I have heard some stories, Major, about the Air Force having been given, I don't think the word seized would apply, various films of UFOs, and that having been returned.
Oh, yes, that's true.
Has that been substantiated?
Yes, that's true. I know one case where that's happened, but that's not the same thing. Usually in those cases, the Air Force asks for the original, and in one case that I know of, because I was right in the middle, I helped handle it, they said they would give the man a copy or two.
When he got the copies, he swore up and down they were useless and demanded the original back. I don't know what ever happened. In that particular case, I'm not sure that these things were bona fide UFOs. They looked to me like sun dogs. But regardless, he didn't get his original back last time I heard about it. But this other thing, there's something he's supposed to be sinister about three men dressed in black. I personally don't find it sinister unless they're undertakers or something like that, but...
That's not
sinister. Huh?
That's the end.
I don't know, but anyway, no one has ever tried to silence me, except in one case where they tried to argue me and not writing it, to not write anymore about that I split and send you this, about flying saucers. That was done in the open, though. It was done in the office of General Story Smith, who was then Director of Information at the Air Force. I had a one-man press conference with Major Jerry Boggs of Intelligence and two or three others, and they tried to convince me that everything that I had heard was wrong and would I not stop talking. When they got through, I said, no, I'm more convinced than ever. You people are sitting on something. And I said, well, then we've wasted our time. But nothing else. No threat.
What do you think are the prospects the Knights have made, and what can be done to improve and enlarge the organization?
Well, that's quite a question, and it's I'm going to give a frank answer. When I went in there a year ago, January, I was told that within a very short time, there would be substantial sums of money coming in to allow us to build it up. We'd have an editor, an editorial assistant, and a promotion man, and public relations, and the other, all of which were badly needed. The sum was estimated at around $50,000. On the basis of this, I announced the NICAP magazine and sent letters to all the people who'd read my books, and we sent out quite a number of them, and we had acceptances. And then, after the acceptances, the people who were going to donate the $50,000 in amounts of $5,000 apiece, most cases, each one began waiting for the other. So as a result, here was NICAP committed to publishing a magazine, which we put out, and to borrow Winston Churchill, blood, sweat, and tears, I think it was right. It was just about that and a little bit more, because sometimes it was sheer desperation. But we did get the magazine out, and it was written to be as new and have as much new material as possible. We alternated with bulletins, and we have done our best to keep going, in spite of the fact we have such a small staff down there. I personally have donated my time since last year. I don't know how long I keep on doing that, but NICAP overnight could become a very terrific success if it just had a larger membership. It's all it needs is a larger membership and a few people, of course, who have been able to have actually sent in donations besides their memberships. But I have a very poor money ratio.
Do you have any idea, Major, pardon me, about how many members it would be necessary to have in order to have a successful organization?
Well, of course, it would be very wonderful if we had 10,000 members, but we could do much less than that. If we had, in addition, we have now, if we had 2,500 more members, or 3,000 more, our problems would be taken care of, because I would immediately get a hold of an editor. In fact, I put my eyes on my friend John DeBerry over here. He used to be on True Magazine. Or someone who knows the subject and could really take over. Because I've been trying to be director, editor, public relations man, and not doing a good job at any of
it. Would you classify NICAP more or less as a mother organization?
No. We were afraid that there would be some jealousy on the part of existing organizations. And at first, I think they thought too that we were trying to take them over. And since then, we've gotten along very well with most of them. Now, some of them don't care too much for our policy, middle-of-the-road policy, for instance. But we're not having much trouble, and once in a while, we get information from them, and we'll be glad to cooperate even more with them, as far as that's concerned. And now, you mentioned one thing. I'm going to talk this then. On the cooperation, we offered the Air Force cooperation, too. Back in July, we offered them an eight-point plan. And someone said, which one of you gentlemen wants? Would we consider negative evidence as well as positive evidence? We said to the Air Force, you claim that you have explained all but 3% of the sightings. If you will let us have the 97% of the cases, since there's no security involved and they're all explained, there's no reason why you shouldn't let us have them. We will turn them over to our advisors and board of governors. If we agree with you and fully explain them, we will then state the Air Force certainly has done everything they claim. They have explained that 97%. We will wipe the nightcap out and say, let's just submit, let's all go home. The Air Force says, we don't want any part of you. They would not release anything. They sent an official letter saying it was rejecting our offer.
I have one last question, Major. On the Armstrong Circle Theater, I recall there was a statistical breakdown as to the number of unexplained and insufficient information. I don't recall the breakdown. It was 1.9 or something on unexplained and 12 point insufficient. In your opinion, should the 12 point of insufficient, if that is the number, be classified as insufficient information or unexplained?
Well, I would have to see each case to answer that, but I'll tell you one thing. That 1.9 is very misleading because that is what they call the current situation. Now, up to November 15th last year, they were advertising that they had explained all the 3%. Then they jumped it suddenly to 1.9. But what they don't let the public realize is that they have a big backlog of unexplained cases. It goes back into the special report 14, and there's a table right in the back that shows 19.5% of this group unexplained, which is about 650, and the total today is well over 700, about 750 unexplained cases, all more than 12% of the total.
Carlin Hagen? When was Project 14 published, Mr. Kehoe?
It was dated May 5th, 1955, and a friend of mine, pretty high up in the Pentagon, told me at that time, he said, they're going to let that go just in time to knock off your book that's coming out in May. I said, that's very interesting, and Henry Holt will appreciate that, because the book is only about one-third written, and it won't be out for months. And he called me up later, and he said, they've just found out your book's not coming out, and they slapped this secret label on this, and they're going to hold it. So they held it until October, at which time Len Springfield, who put out Crypho, made a mistake and said in his book that I was coming out in November with the Flying Saucer Conspiracy. And that afternoon at 5 o'clock, Captain Robert White got orders from topside, let it go. So they let it go, and the press man around the Pentagon didn't have any time to get the answers to it. They said, what's it all about this time of the day? Hey. He said, wait, here it is. Explained all the 3%, they ran the story, and all over the United States. And then our book didn't come out till December. By that time, things had sort of cooled up. Also, Rupert's book was coming out. So they figured they'd knock this book off at the same time. And that is the most misleading document, I think, that's ever been put out. Now, I don't say they're lying to the people, but it's either the most complete blunder or misstatement that has ever been published that I've ever seen, or just a deliberate deception.
Major Kehoe, why doesn't the Air Force want NICAP?
Well, they know very well that our intention is to get everything out in the open and to try to get the answers made available to the press. In fact, one suggestion we had was that they hold a huge press conference and bring out everything, and we will be over there giving our side and asking questions too. Let's get it out in the open, and that's one thing they will never agree to. So there are too many questions that were just not, they couldn't answer. And that's also why we want this Senate investigation.
Couldn't answer, or they don't want to answer?
Oh, they can answer some of them, most of them, but I do think there's some things that they don't understand even yet about these. I'm not even sure they know the motives. And I'm sure they know that these things operate in cycles, and they probably know the method of propulsion. I think they do have a good idea of the type of beings involved, although I'm not sure of that. And they know very well that they're real and that they're from some other part of the universe.
Could you repeat that again a moment?
They know they're real.
Now, who knows?
The Air Force knows.
The Air Force knows what?
That these objects are real and they're objects under intelligent control of beings from some other part of the universe, either our solar system or outside.
Howard Chop stated that, didn't he, in 1953, when he was, after he was head of the information,
the Pentagon? He didn't say it that way. What he said was that there was a secret report, which had been held up, and I found out which one it was later on. That was the Foreign Aid Report, And then but the 1948 report was the big one. That was the one where ATIC declared these things were interplanetary spaceships. And even though all AFOs have accepted, that was the top brains at that time in intelligence.
Thank you very, very much, Major Kehoe. I certainly appreciate it, and I know our listeners do, to have the opportunity of hearing your opinions on this subject, and I sincerely hope that when and if you do come back to New York, and if you can spare the time, that you will join us again.